If you have your Bibles, turn to the Song of Solomon, chapter 2, where Anthony read from. Kind of following a progression here in the song. In the Sunday morning service, we looked at the emptiness of humanity, portrayed particularly in the book of Ecclesiastes, where Solomon, having observed life, his report on human existence outside of the Lord is that it's all vanity, it's all futility. The answer to that, in a sense, is not just God, but God known through Jesus Christ, and not just those kinds of words that we agree with, that it's Christ that we need, but it's the experiential application of the gospel to our own souls. Last night we looked at the paralysis that can creep in when we do draw near to our God through Jesus Christ. There is the feeling that the gap between where we are and the transcendence and the holiness of God, there's the feeling that that's so great that God wouldn't want to draw near to his people. And we go from being the kind of people that think that it's the easiest thing in the world to walk with the Lord to the kind of people that think that there's no reason God would ever want to know us or draw us to himself. And so both are lies. The answer, of course, is in the cross. In the Song of Solomon, we looked at the description that the husband gives of the bride and then the description she gives of the husband. We looked at those using New Testament truths to kind of fill those pictures with meaning. Tonight I want us to look at the spiritual seasons in a Christian's life. The spiritual seasons in a Christian's life. And again tonight, let's kind of step back from the Song of Solomon. Very unusual book for us. Thousands of years old, Middle Eastern, love poetry. It's just not something you can jump in or read over casually and really get it. So there are some keys that we have that will help us. And one of the keys is that we need to understand that the distance or the nearness or distance of God to or from his people is not static. It's not constant. The relationship that the believer has with God is constant. It's based, of course, upon the finished work of Christ. But the fellowship, if we can use that term, the sense of intimacy, the awareness of God, and the awareness of God's work among us, the nearness or distance of God is not always the same. If it's always the same, then you have a lot of verses in the Bible that make no sense at all. Things like, draw near to the Lord and he will draw near to you. And that's said to a group of Christians. Or, return unto me and I will return unto you. And that's said to his people in the Old Testament. Old Testament, New Testament, no difference in the way that God is speaking about his distance. In the Old Covenant, he could be near his people. In the Old Covenant, he could be distant from his people. People, of course, in the New Covenant, we experience much greater privileges. The veil is torn. We, in a sense, by faith, are introduced into the Holy of Holies. And yet still, in the New Testament, you find Paul quoting Old Testament passages to talk about New Testament privileges, and he says, because you have these promises, cleanse yourself from all defilement of the flesh, what we do, and of the spirit, what we think or desire, so that you can enjoy this nearness. The Bible speaks of the presence of God in different ways. I believe that Anthony, not long ago, looked at the presence of God. There's the omnipresence of God, but that is essentially, because God is who he is everywhere at once. He cannot be near or far from any place, nearer or farer in that sense. He is everywhere. He doesn't travel. He doesn't make an effort to be in every place at once. It's what he is. Then there are passages that don't describe the essential presence of God, but they describe that kind of presence of God that is noticeable, the manifest presence of God, the old writers have called it, or the cultivated presence of God. And when we think of these terms, we must not think of them in geographical categories, like God is far, and then when we repent, and we kneel down and cry out to the Lord, then God somehow travels to us. It's not a geographical distance, it's a relational distance. So, there are times, right, married couples, where you sit beside each other on the couch at the end of the week, the kids are in bed, and you just sit there, and there's a sweet nearness. Not geographic, right, but relational. Then there are times, end of the week, it's not been such a good week, and you haven't perhaps been a very nice spouse, and the kids are in bed, and you're sitting beside each other on the couch, and there's 1,000 miles between you. Not geographically, relationally. Kids, there's times where you can sit beside dad, and you feel like, I'm just so glad he's my dad. And then there's other times that dad sits beside you, and you think, oh, I wish I was 1,000 miles away. I have had times, I remember as a teenager, trying to lift some weights, all right? Look, when you're my size, you got to do something. So I got all that I could get on the bar, you know, which I weighed about, I weighed 88 pounds going into the ninth grade, right? So I get 100 pounds on the bar, and my dad, I was very rebellious and a lost teenager, and I had smarted off to my dad, and I was in trouble. He's in the living room, he's reading his Bible, we had a small house. He was in seminary at the time. The only place I could lift weights was in the living room, so I had to endure my dad's presence. Like, go in there all 15 years old and mad and frustrated with the world and demanding my rights. And I get under the weights and I'm really going to town until like the 11th rep and then it's not going anywhere. And I had, you know, pinned the weight from there and there was no way. And I tried to do the roll down and it hit the floating rim and I rolled it back up and finally, I had to say to my dad, well, fine, you're going to help me. And of course, he was just watching me until I would humble myself. There are times when geographically you can be right next to a person, but relationally, you're thousands of miles away from each other. When we think of God, every human on planet Earth is surrounded by God. But listen, believer, we do not only want what every person on planet Earth can have. If you're a believer, you've been united to God through Christ. You're the spouse. You're the child. You want what family gets, not what strangers get. God is in church on Sunday morning, but God is in the brothel. God is in a crack house, and God is in the mosque. He's everywhere. But the believer wants more of God than what the other places can. Well, God does draw near to his people in wonderful ways, and then God does also withdraw his presence at times. We find this from Genesis to Revelation. The older writers, 200 years ago, 300, 400, 500 years ago, tended to be much more careful in discussing the presence of God. I mean, we're very careless about that. I remember reading somewhat of a kind of a charismatic pastor, he was a TV preacher at the time, who said that every morning he would get up and shave and Jesus would show up in his bathroom. And I read a remark that John MacArthur had made. They were kind of talking back and forth. And he said to MacArthur, do you believe that? I mean, like physically shows up in my bathroom. MacArthur said, well, I don't know. Let me just ask you this question. What do? When he shows up, you keep shaving? He said, yeah. He said, no, I don't believe that. Well, we're not so careful either. Sometimes you can have a great choir special. Now, you probably can't have a great choir special. I don't see the choir loft. We don't have a choir loft, but you can have a great special. Someone sings a song, they do a great job, and it's the kind of song that stirs the emotion, and it's the kind of voice that's great. And you hear people in church all the time say, oh, I just felt that God was there. Really what they mean is my emotions were really stirred by a religious theme. But it doesn't mean that God has drawn near in the way that the Bible describes. There are very clear evidences of God drawing near and God withdrawing. That's not our topic tonight, so I've got to keep moving. When the old writers discussed the nearness or distance of God from his people relationally, they often used the theme of seasons. So they would say it's a springtime because God has come near. And just like in spring, it's like everything bursts into life. All the same things that we were doing last week, or last month, or last year. Same Bible studies, same songs, same prayer meetings, but now they are alive. And then there are winter times. that the old writers talk about. All the same things, but it seems dry. And it's like winter sunlight. Very clear, but cold. Edward Payson was one of those preachers that was very careful. Early 1800s, he was a young pastor, renowned for his godliness. He ministered during the Second Great Awakening in the United States and in the New England area. And Edward Payson's church never saw the degree of revival, the nearness of God that he really wanted. They did see seasons of gracious visitation, he would say, but never really like the other churches in the Great Awakening. It bothered him. But he was very careful when he talked about the presence of God. In his works, three-volume works that you can buy today still, he had two sermons that I remember finding and reading, benefiting by. The first was this: God's special presence distinguishes his own people. From the book of Exodus. How will people know that we're your people unless God is among us? Second sermon: how to prolong the gracious visits of the Lord. Now, when is the last time you heard a sermon on how to prolong the gracious visits of the Lord? It's just not a thing that we really deal with. The Song of Solomon, I mean, you can read the old writers, but really the scripture is full of passages that describe God's nearness, distance, what affects that, how we recognize that. The Song of Solomon, in that poetic, wonderful way, that impressionistic art, gives us a lot of information about this dynamic of God's nearness and fluctuations. In chapter 3, if you have the Bible, turn there. Chapter 3, in the first few verses, we see one of the examples, and then we see another one in chapter 5, but we're going to spend the time in chapter 2. Let me just mention these other two. In chapter 3, we find the lazy desires of the wife are replaced by a very aggressive seeking, and she finds him. So look at verse 1. On my bed, night after night, I saw him, whom my soul loves. I must arise now and go about the city, in the streets and in the squares. I must seek him whom my soul loves. I saw him, but I did not find him. The watchmen who make the rounds in the city found me, and I said, have you seen him whom my soul loves? Scarcely had I left him when I found him whom my soul loved. I held on to him and would not let him go. Wonderful picture of the stirring of the heart. She's on her bed at night, in her spiritual pajamas, everything's comfortable, and she wishes that the husband were closer. But you can wish all you want. So finally she decides that it's too much to stay in bed, so she gets up, puts her clothes on, and she goes throughout the city. The queen is looking. Where is my king? Where's the one my soul loves? And when she really is in earnest, scarcely has she begun to search the city, she finds him. She grabs hold of him. She won't let him go. Chapter 5 is not nearly as encouraging. This time we have an indifferent wife whose heart is finally provoked by the husband's love. And then she gets out and searches for him. And she doesn't find him in chapter 5, but at least her heart is once again aflame with love. And when the men of the city, the watchmen, see the queen, they don't know it's the queen, and they say to her, who are you looking for? Oh, I'm looking for my love. Well, what kind of love is it that you're out in the middle of the night searching for him? And she gives this great description of her love. But look at just the first few verses. Look at verse 2. I was asleep, but my heart was awake. A voice. My beloved was knocking. Open to me, my sister, my darling, my love, my dove, sorry, my perfect one. For my head is drenched with dew, my locks with the damp of the night. Right? So the picture is this: the husband is on the outside. He knocks on the door and he says, open up, it's me. And he's been there. The dew has made his hair wet. But this is the indifference of the wife. Look at the next verse. I've taken off my dress. How can I put it on again? I've washed my feet. How can I get them dirty again? My love extended his hand to the opening, and my feelings were aroused for him. I arose to open to my glove, my hands dripped with myrrh, my fingers with liquid myrrh on the handles of the bowl. I opened to my beloved, but my beloved had turned away and had gone. My heart went out to him as he spoke. I searched for him, but I did not find him. I called him, but he did not answer. And then she meets the watchman, and then she gives those descriptions. So there's a very different scene. He knocks. She says, "Oh, look, be great. You know, I mean, I really love you and everything, but I'm already tired. I'm in bed and I don't really want to see you." So finally, her heart is stirred, but by the time her heart is stirred, he's already gone. Chapter 2, she gives us a much healthier portrait of a loving wife and of a responsive church. Now, chapter 2, the setting, we're going to begin in verse 8. But the setting really, I want to look at the contrast with verse 7. Up to chapter 2, verse 7, we've been looking at that. She longs for him, he draws her near, she complains, "I'm not the royal daughter like the other queens. I'm not the beautiful prince's daughter. I'm sunburnt, I'm a commoner." And he describes his love for her, and she describes her love for him. And in verse 7, she's been brought to his banqueting hall, his banner over her, his love. And then in verse 7, it's the husband speaking, and he says, "I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or the hinds of the field, that you will not arouse or awaken my love until she pleases me." And so it's a picture. The husband says, "Look, she's with me. Don't bother her. I like having her here. Nobody come in and awaken." Verse 8 is really the beginning of a completely new section in the psalm. The scene has changed. I think it would be simplest just to kind of describe from what we see in the verses what the scene would be. She's in the royal gardens, and she's in some kind of structure, like what we think of as a gazebo, made up a little hut down in the royal gardens, and it's made up of latticework wood, and there's windows in it. And she's sitting out there, and Solomon, the husband, has been gone for a long time. And she sits in the royal gardens, and she longs for his return. She is waiting for him, and it is a winter time for her. Look at verse 8. Well, no, I don't want to look at verse 8 yet, because that's when things change. All right, so let's just kind of take that picture. She's sitting in the gazebo. As we read these verses, we get this picture. She's longing, she's waiting, he's gone, she's not happy. It's a spiritual winter time. Now, there are often times like that for believers. There are times where God does withdraw his wonderful presence, and he seems to have been gone for a long time. And there are a couple of reasons for this. And the first reason that we really have to wrestle with is this. There's often sin in our hearts that is at the root of the withdrawal of God's wonderful manifest presence. Listen to these passages. Hosea 5, after 5 chapters of describing the idolatry in Israel's heart, in verse 15 he says this, "I will return again to my place until they acknowledge their offense. Then they will seek my face in their affliction. They will earnestly seek me." You see the picture? After 5 chapters or 4 chapters of preaching, into the 5th chapter, God says, "You're not listening. So this is what I'll do. In order to get your attention, I will withdraw myself from my own people," like he threatened to do back in the Exodus. "Yes, you're still my people. We still have a covenant relationship. But I will withdraw myself, and you will notice the difference. And when you're miserable, you'll come looking for me." Isaiah 59, Isaiah reminds the people, "Your iniquities have separated you from your God, and your sins have hidden his face from you, so they will not hear." All through the Psalms, you find this kind of imagery. God, turn your face toward us. God, do not give us your back. These are all relational descriptions, a sense of distance or a sense of nearness. In Isaiah 63, Isaah lists God's, at the beginning of the chapter, he goes through this list of how God has treated Israel like a father treats a son, and he's so kind to the son that in this human language, in this anthropomorphic picture of God, it's as if God is a father who looks at Israel and says, "Surely, a son that's treated that well would never rebel." And then Israel does rebel. Isaiah says in chapter 63, God became their enemy. That is, he opposed them. Then Isaiah begins to list the evidences that God is opposing them. And one of the things he says over and over is this. He asks this sentence, "Where is he?" Do you ever ask that question? Do you think that all the problems in the American church are just doctrine problems, or maybe we need new leaders or better buildings or more clever youth ministers or more traditional churches or more hipster churches? I mean,
Do you only think on the horizontal level? Isaiah looks at Israel. He reads his Old Testament. He looks at Israel and he says, where is he? Where is he who led them up out of Egypt? Where is he who rescued our fathers, who walked them through? Where is he? And then he gives evidences of God's withdrawal of his presence. Now, that's Old Testament. You might think it's only Old Testament. In Revelation chapter 3, the church of Laodicea, of course, has compromised in her arrogance. She feels she's self-sufficient. Christ speaks to the church. And one of the things we find is that he's outside the door of the church, a very popular image for evangelism. Not wrong to use it for evangelism, but that is not what it's talking about. It's the church. So he's outside the church. He's knocking on the door of the church. What's he doing outside the church? They have offended him. Their sins have grieved him. And he has, as a measure of judgment, just like in Hosea, just like in Isaiah 59 or 63, he has withdrawn from them. There is the loss of that fellowship. They're still his church. They're still Christians. But they're inside playing church. And he's outside. So he knocks on the door and he says to them, if you would repent, I would come in. And we'd sit down and have supper together, a picture of friendship renewed. If we are a people who wish to keep the company of our favorite sins, we are a people who would definitely lose the company of our Lord. It's always right when we feel that we are in a spiritual wintry season and that God has somehow withdrawn his influences. It's always right to begin with this question. God, is there something in my life that I have embraced that offends you? Now, there are other times or other reasons that God has for withdrawing his manifest presence from his people. And that we can see in the book of Job and other places. But we could summarize it like this. That sometimes God backs up to teach us to walk by faith. Samuel Rutherford, the Scottish preacher, my all-time super-duper favorite, was in prison for preaching the gospel in the 1600s. And he said, I find that we can have a little Jerusalem on earth. And what he's talking about is, it's like, he said in another place, in another letter to a friend, he said, I feel like I'm in the suburbs of heaven, peeking over a wall and seeing God because he's drawn near to him in this jail. He also said, there's more to be experienced of Christ than I ever thought. I was only at the ABCs up to this point. But Rutherford recognized the danger that when the Lord seemed to be so frequently near, he said, I find I make two Christs. Christ and then the enjoyment of Christ. And I end up having two gods in my heart. I love the sense of God's nearness. But I know that I love it. And I'm afraid it becomes idolatrous. There are times where God withdraws that sense of his presence to grow us up, to teach us to walk by faith. Now, Rutherford from prison wrote this, grace groweth best when? In winter. Now, not many things grow best in winter, but grace grows best in winter. What does he mean? In times where things are difficult for the believer, that's when we really seem to humble ourselves and to lay hold of Christ and to really grow through the hard times. It's not when things are easy and you're part of a great church and all your friends seem to be moving forward and you're moving forward and you're reading a great book that just came out and your preacher's preaching a series of sermons that just seem to fill you with happiness. It's a summertime where everything spiritual in your backyard is growing and you look out the window and you think, I have arrived. I'm a spiritual giant. Look at my garden. It's lush. The problem is that when things are easy for believers, it's not just gracious, Christ-like things that grow. There's a lot of other stuff that grows right alongside of it. And we think that we've made great strides as believers. The only way to know is when the winter comes and it blasts the garden and you look out your window during hard times, you look at your life and you think, it's all dead. I thought I was a spiritual giant. I'm a spiritual pygmy. But it's not all dead. You walk out there, you see there's a sapling. There's an oak. It's not very big. It's not a lot of green stuff around it, but it's real. That's the stuff that's real. The other stuff is the feelings and in times things are easy. It really looks like we're obeying and moving forward. Again, Samuel Rutherford said, every ship seems to be seaworthy when the sails are full of the breeze and they all go out. But when a storm comes, the ones that weren't built well, they sink. Every person in a church, when things are going great and the flush of emotions, you come to the church, you get new friends. It's just wonderful. And you think that you've reached this great pinnacle of spiritual perfection. But be careful. When the winter comes, you may find that not everything that was growing was really grace. So there are times where God seems to withdraw. We're still His people. But He withdraws in order to show us, right, what's real and what's not. Now, this brings us to the whole question of objective truth and subjective truth. And this is where we get into trouble, all right? Because we all have our favorite side, left-brainers and right-brainers. I'm definitely the one that doesn't like math, all right? So I like the liberal arts stuff. I like the Christian poetry. I like the word pictures. And if someone wants to dissect the book of Ephesians in the Greek and spend 7 or 8 years dissecting Greek phrases, I would definitely fall asleep and volunteer for nursery each week. I mean, I love Ephesians, but I don't want to treat it that way. I think of Christianity as the great romance, as the pilgrimage, as the journey. And someone else may think of it as a list of rules. We all have our tendency, but listen, there's objective truth and there's the subjective application of Christian truth, and they both have to be wed. They're like two rails that the train runs on. If you substitute your favorite one for the other, you will certainly derail. They're both essential to the Christian life, but there is an order. Objective truth is primary. That's what we look at. And as we look at objective truth and understand what God is revealing and apply it to life, subjective experiences flow from that. So you can't, even though they're both essential, they're not both primary. Objective truth, what God says is real, is primary. The experience of that in the Christian life is secondary. Root and fruit. In a marriage, it's the same way. You can be a person who courts someone, all right? I'm not allowed to say the word date any longer now. But, okay, but you can court someone. And you can court someone. And you can feel madly in love. And you can feel that you love them as much as any married couple has ever loved each other. And you can imagine, you can look at yourself and your feelings. And you look at people been married 20 years and you think they don't even know what love is. Love was invented when I met Sally, all right? But it doesn't matter what your feelings are. You are not married. Now, let's not be so silly. You can sleep with someone. You're not married. You can move in together. You're not married. You can be married and wake up and look at each other and think, oh, and you're still married. All right? There are wonderful experiences in marriage, but they don't make you married. Marriage is a real union that includes a legal recognition. It's a union before God. It's a union before our state. There is a document, a marriage license. Sometimes we wake up and we've not been nice to each other and we think, I wonder if they're going to leave me. But then you think, no, it's not a boyfriend and a girlfriend. It's a marriage. There is an objective truth in marriage. I am the husband of a girl named Misty Snyder. And I can act like a complete jerk, but I'm still the husband of a girl named Misty Snyder. But who is satisfied with the objective truth of marriage only? Do you parents that have kids and you don't get free time from the kids as often. You get a babysitter. Let's say Anthony and Hannah, they get a babysitter and they're going to have a date on Friday night. They just can't wait. Oh, the kids are with friends and we're just going to go away. We're just going to go away for the weekend. We've got the time off. And do you think that Anthony would be thrilled if Hannah pulled out on the date the marriage certificate and said, oh, I just love this thing. And Anthony's over there like, well, here I am. Yeah, I know. Oh, We're married. I'm married to that guy. Nobody sits and looks at the marriage document. You look at the spouse. There are people who go from a very light and unbiblical view of God to a more serious and biblical view of God. They say, well, I'm reformed now. It's not really a perfect term, but they say I'm reformed. Listen, I have friends that have gone reformed, and I would agree with them on paper. But when they go reformed, all they want to talk to me about from that point forward is covenantalism. They just want to talk about covenant, covenant, covenant. The covenant is a wonderful metaphor that God has given us to help our weak faith. When we look at us and we think, I don't see why he would still love us. You have a marriage license. Look at it. He's still yours. But do not fall in love with the marriage license. You look at the license and say, I can't believe it, but I really belong to Christ. And then you go to Christ through these wonderful truths. So there is objective truth in a marriage, and then there's experience. All right. John Newton. After he was converted, he wrote this hymn. How tedious and tasteless the hours when Jesus no longer I see. Sweet prospects, sweet birds and sweet flowers have all lost their sweetness to me. The midsummer sun shines but dim. The fields strive in vain to look gay. But when I am happy in him, December's as pleasant as May. Then he says this, listen, content with beholding his face, my all to his pleasure resigned. No changes of season or place would make any change in my mind. While blessed with a sense of his love, a palace, a toy would appear, and prisons would palaces prove, if Jesus would dwell with me there. Right. Truth? Yes. Focused on. Experienced. It's a marriage. All right, well, now, during times of absence, what are we to do? Well, look at the bride. She's in the royal garden. She has all those privileges like we've talked before, and yet she is not satisfied because she wants the husband, not the husband's fancy gardens and palace. I think if we can just get some practical things before we go further in the passage, some things we need to do in winter time spiritually. Start with the question, is there anything, God, in my life that offends you? You wouldn't want to come and sit beside me in my spiritual living room because there's a lot of other things in the living room that I know you don't like. The second thing to do is you must refuse to fill your life with other distractions. This wife could have, in chapter 2, she could have said she was with a great bunch of friends. She was with the royal ladies. She was having a banquet. I mean, she doesn't need Solomon for that. Why is she in the garden all by herself when she's the queen? Because she refuses to be satisfied with anything else. She wants him, not other stuff. When there are wintry times, it's so easy to go turn the television on. It's so easy to go to the mall and buy yourself something new. It's easy to go online. It's easy to call a friend. But there are times in spiritual winters where we have to be very careful that those things, those nice things, don't become fillers. So that we, unlike the queen, we're not longing for Christ. If Christ is going to be distant, well, fine, we say. Well, I've got all these other nice things. And the third thing, it is important to set our hearts to look for him with expectation. If we're dealing with sin, if we're not allowing other things to clog up our heart, then there is biblical reason to expect that he will come near again in his time. When you feel a sense of the loss of the presence of God, it's very tempting to believe the lie of the liar who says to your soul, you know he's not here anymore because he's quit loving you. But your present experience is not the measure of Christ's love. Again, Samuel Rutherford. If I had tattoos, it'd be a Samuel Rutherford tattoo, but I don't have any tattoos, all right? So Samuel Rutherford said this, your heart is not the compass that Christ sails the ship by. He has described his love for you in that covenant. Get acquainted with the small print of the new covenant. Ransack Paul's letters so that in periods of winter, as you're making sure that you're not clinging to some known sin and you're not filling up on nice other things, as you wait for him, you have some answer for the liar who comes and says, well, he's not here because he's sick of you. He's found somebody else. If you believe those lies, it'll be the end of your seeking him. Well, verse 8. And by the way, that's the introduction, but that's about 2/3 of our talk tonight, right? So don't faint on me. Verse 8, we have the return of the king. And she doesn't see him at first. She hears him. She's out. She's looking at the hills. There's mountains around. She looks at the mountains. He's not there. She looks. He's not there. She turns away. One day, she hears. She hears his voice. She looks. It's him. It's the one she loves. And he is coming, climbing over the mountains, leaping over these hills like a gazelle. He's not trudging back home. It's like it's an effortless return. Great picture. His return, the voice. Now, I want you to think about this. In spiritual winter times, when God restores us, there is that voice of God. And I don't mean an audible voice, you understand that. But there is the time where you open the Bible and you're in the quiet time again, and it may not have been very, you know, apparently beneficial yesterday or the day before. Maybe it's been a long time, but you humble yourself again and you open the book and you say to God, God, I need you. You know, I need you. And it's your timing. I'm not the boss here, but God, I'm setting my face toward you again. And then it's just illuminated. And it couldn't be clearer if he talked audibly to you. And there is the restoration of the awareness of his love and that you belong to him and that he belongs to you. And there is the sweetest fellowship, so much so you think you'd never sin again. We have those kinds of times. What a voice. It's great to hear the voice of your best friend. It's great to hear the voice of your spouse. But the voice of God restoring those seasons of springtime. It's the voice that called all things into existence. It's the voice that Anthony read about yesterday. The voice of the Lord is over the waters. Psalm 29. The voice of the Lord is powerful. The voice of the Lord is full of majesty, the psalmist says. The voice of the Lord breaks cedars, splinters the cedars of Lebanon. It makes the calf to skip. It divides the flame of fire. It shakes the wilderness. It makes the deer give birth and the strips the forests bare, and everyone in God's temple says glory. There is no voice like his. And when he directs it to us in these wintry spells and we hear it, it's effective. The voice of the Lord, same voice that called Lazarus from the grave. It's the same voice that will call all humanity and angels before him to judge them. It's the voice that Jesus says his sheep will hear when he says, follow me. And it's the voice that revives a languishing Christian. And it's not just that it's this almighty, irresistible voice of a king. Look what he says to her. Rise up, my love, my fair one, and come away. And a couple statements down, he says more. Rise up, my love. Oh, my dove, in the clefts of the rock, in the secret places of the cliff, let me see your face. Let me hear your voice. Your voice is sweet and your face is lovely. Again, one of those passages where he describes that he loves her and he finds her lovely. When Christ speaks, it's effective. When he speaks gently upon the heart of the believer, there's no voice like that. It's not just effective. It's not just powerful. He says things to us that we find hard to believe. But when he says them, it's not like when a preacher says them. We believe them. Can you bear to be indifferent to that husband when that kind of statement comes to you? How does he come? Well, that's the voice, but how does he come? Not unwilling, not grudgingly. Leaping, we mentioned, effortlessly. At the end of the passage, she talks about those mountains again in verse 17. Until the cool of the day when the shadows flee away, turn, my beloved, be like a gazelle or a young stag on the mountains of Bether. The mountains of Bether. The Hebrew word's not easy to understand. There's some disagreement on it, but most agree that it ought to be translated the mountains of separation or the mountains of difficulty. I want us to think about that in the sense of a Christian's experience. There are times when God has withdrawn his presence from the church or from an individual, and there are mountains between us. Look at your life. sins of the flesh, things you're doing that offend God, things you're thinking, your imagination, your memories. Which ones do you let come back and do you treasure? Do you bring back old sinful activities and you kind of polish them off and look at them and then think, oh, well, not supposed to be. Think about sins of the heart. And he comes and he speaks to the heart. Do you feel that there's no way he could come to you because there are mountains there? Look at the church. There's mountains of difficulty between Jesus Christ and the American church. Look at our nation. I mean, anywhere you look, you see mountains and you think, I can't imagine Jesus Christ coming back, you know, in the sense of drawing near to a people again. I mean, this whole theme of revival and the historical accounts we read of it, George Whitefield, Jonathan Edwards, all these, you know, all the people in the city coming to hear, thousands being converted, people being transformed, families being transformed, cities being transformed. John Wesley went to one place down in Devonshire, southern England, really beautiful place. He went there and he said it's the only city he'd ever been, the only town he'd ever been, where he could not find one lost adult. Now, it was the Great Awakening, but that had not happened in any other place. When he traveled to Wales, and they're all kind of Presbyterian and he wasn't, you know, so he didn't really like their theology, he wrote back to a friend and said, this is the most Christ-like, the most New Testament-like place I've ever been. We can't even imagine that kind of transformation. Now, and we look and all we see is the mountains. There are mountains of difficulty. But when we cry out to the Lord, do not underestimate His zeal. For the sake of His name, for the sake of His bride, for the sake of the sheep that He has not yet gathered, when He comes, He will not, you will not find Christ pushing up the mountain, dragging a heavy load and saying, hold on now. Get there soon. It's just hard work coming over these mountains. When He comes, He comes. Do you know how the old writers described revival? They said it like this. It is like a nation was born in a moment. It's not exactly what happened, but it's how it feels when He comes. There are pastors in early American history. You can read their accounts. Pastors, nice men, moral men, probably not very spiritual men, and they wrote letters during the Great Awakening, and George Whitefield would come to their town, and they didn't really like George Whitefield. He's a bit radical in their opinion. And so when he left, though, they would write this in their journals, all right, April, first week. More people knocking on my door all hours of day and night, asking me for spiritual advice, more people in 1 week than I had in the last 3 years. And they were angry, not happy. They were mad. I have office hours between 2 and 2:30 on every third Thursday of the month. You know, I mean, they didn't want everybody. But when God drew near, even the preachers that didn't want to talk to people about their souls complained that people continued to come to them asking them, how do I find peace with God? When God comes, when He restores an individual, when He restores a church, if He decides to restore a nation, He comes effortlessly over the things that have divided us. He is able, He is willing, doubt no more, the hymn says. Now, what are the effects of His return? When Christ speaks, when Christ seems to draw near to the individual believer or a church, what happens? Well, she describes it here. It's a spiritual springtime. He looks through the windows. He peers through the lattice. And then He says to her, come away with me, my darling, my beautiful one. Come along. For behold, He says, verse 11, the winter is past. The rain is over and gone. The flowers have already appeared in the land. The time has arrived for pruning the vines. The voice of the turtle dove has been heard in our land. The fig tree has ripened its figs. The vines in blossom have given forth their fragrance. Arise, my darling, my beautiful one, and come along. It's a springtime. Now, obviously, this is poetic. When He's gone, it's winter. She's a queen and she has a lot of privileges, but it's winter. When He's there, everything comes to life. Have you seen young couples like this? Older couples like this? wife is in the room. She's talking to people. Some husband's been away on a trip. Maybe you're at church. He says, I'll meet you there. I'm running late. He walks into the room. She's talking to you. And then she sees him. Her face lights up. And then she quits listening to you. When he returns, the sights and the sounds and the smells and the bird song of life return. Now, sadly, the American church, not being willing to give up, or the American religious scene, not really being willing to give up the mountains of compromise. All that we're left with, if we will not repent, is to try to replicate this ourselves. And so because we have money and talent and we're a big country, we can do this. Now, other countries don't do so well as we do at replicating this wonderful springtime. But here's what we do. We make an announcement. There's going to be a new church in the area. We send out our advertisers. We send out questionnaires. What do you want in a church? And they come back, and then we craft the church. Then we have the preparation. We have the core team. We have everything. Then we have opening day or the launch. And then when people come, we've got great music and we've got great performances, short talks by very talented speakers, drama. I mean, it's just thrilling. It's like a spiritual springtime. I mean, everyone's excited to come to the new church. Within months, it's running hundreds of people. It's starting satellite campuses. You know what I'm talking about. What are we doing? Well, unless it's Christ that's the real attraction, what we're really doing is, instead of a springtime, we're bringing in a bunch of plastic flowers and putting them around the graves. And we're telling everybody, it's just so beautiful in here. But when you get close to the plastic flower on the grave, it's not so attractive, is it? From a distance, it's impressive. Cemeteries look great. I mean, not much happening there, but they look great. You get close and you see it's just plastic. I am no longer encouraged when someone tells me, do you know there's a new Reformed church plant starting down the road? Do you know that there's a guy that reads John Piper all the time? No, I'm not blaming John Piper. He reads John Piper and he's planting a church down the road. There's a guy that loves Paul Washer and he's planting a church down the road. I used to get really excited. Like, it's a revival. I mean, it's a stirring. These are happening everywhere. And you watch, and after about 2 years, they're just like the church they left. But their plastic is cheaper because they don't have the big bank accounts that the big first church used to have. We are replicating springtime in our churches with plastic flowers. When God does it, it's so different. So different. Let me give you one illustration. When I lived in the little country of Wales, the bump on the west side of England, that's what the English call it. The Welsh call it the center of the universe, right? In the summertime, the sun rises about 4:15 in the morning. So by 5 in the morning, it looks like it's noon. It's really quite nice if you want to get up. Now, the British people stay up late and don't get up early. They don't understand Americans. So if you see the early dog walkers in Britain, it's 7 o'clock. So if you can get up early, if you can make yourself get up early, you can have a couple of hours walking through the woods. And so I lived in the city of Cardiff, and on the outskirts of Cardiff, about a 2 mile walk from my house, was a patch of woods on a mountain called the Winolt. It's actually mentioned in George Whitfield's journals. And the Winolt is just a big piece of property that nobody's been allowed to timber yet. So there's still these ancient forests. And so you walk through there. Now, I would go there and take my Bible, and there was a big flat rock, and I would sit on that big flat rock in the middle of the patch of woods on the outskirts of the city and have a quiet time sometimes if I was really ambitious, because I don't really like waking up. I went 1 week this particular year that we were there, and then I went the next week. I could not believe the difference. The bluebells had come out. I didn't know what a bluebell was. I grew up in Columbus, Ohio. I mean, I never saw a bluebell. I thought it was ice cream. So I go to the mountain. So I walk out, and I'm not exaggerating. The entire mountain, the entire hillside is a carpet of purple that wasn't there at all a week before. That's the way it is when God works in the church. We labor, we strive, we cry out, we witness, we obey, we do the work we're supposed to do, we use the means that God has placed in our hands, but perhaps it may seem that nothing's happening, we're still stuck in this spiritual winter, but when He decides to come, you don't have to replicate it or fabricate it, you don't have to work yourselves up. You wake up and you look and you come to church, and it's like someone has in the middle of the night planted this beautiful spring in front of you. It's God. that does that. We have a hymn in our hymn book that says, "The means of grace are in our hand, but the blessing is at His command." I have to pray. I have to study. There are times to fast. Not just from food, but television, friends, activities that I like to make time for God. I have to join together with other believers to worship. I have to talk to other believers and ask them to help me, to hold me accountable. I make use of all the tools that God has given me. But when He comes over the mountains of difficulty, the normal means are flooded with life. He calls her to go away with Him. And she comes away from every distraction and walks with Him. Now, that's the picture, but it's not exactly the end of the story. There's one more thing I want us to see. In verse 15, as she's walking away with the husband and the land is full of spring, she turns and says, all right, to the palace workers, wait, hold on, Solomon. Hey, you guys, watch the foxes. The little foxes, you know, they come about this time of year. They steal the little grapes off the vine. They strip it clean. They're little. You don't think they're a big problem, but they will strip everything bare. In spiritual springtimes, when it's like everything is on autopilot and it's wonderful, make sure that you add one more element. You must be careful, not careless. Now, Americans, what religious are American evangelicalism? If you go to the bookstore and you look at titles, you'll see like all of our catchwords right now, you know, kind of reveal what we're good at. So you have radical or empowered or whatever. But one word that I really think is a word that I am looking forward to living long enough for it to pass out of the fad, the vogue, so that it would be worth something again, is the word passion. It's not a bad word. It's just everybody talks about it. My passion for donuts, my passion for Jesus. It's the same thing to some people. Now, we are great at passion. We're not known around the world for being careful believers. There are people who are careful around the world. But we're not the ones. We're the passion people. When times of extraordinary privilege and blessing come from the Lord as a church, when you enjoy wonderful seasons of the nearness of God and things seem like they're in the springtime again, you must be on guard. Now, let me give you what to guard against. First of all, obviously, the little sins. The eyes. The ears. What are you going to listen to? The mouth. What do you say? The thoughts, the memories. When I was converted, it was in the middle of studying in college for the ministry. Don't ask me why in the world I thought I should be a minister before as a believer. Of course, I thought I was a Christian because I walked down the aisle at age 9. I was in the midst of studying in those 4 years at college, and I was really finally captured by Christ. And it was the springtime, you know. I mean, that's what conversion is. Now, I remember to this day going in with a friend to get a VHS, a video to watch that weekend. You know, we were college guys. Okay, let's go get a video. It was a fine video. I mean, I don't even remember what we were watching, but there wasn't anything wrong with that choice. But to walk to the section where we would find the video that we thought was acceptable for Christians, I walked past a section that was not acceptable. And I saw out of the corner of my eye something. And I stopped and looked for a second. And I felt the loss. And I regret that look 23 years later. I mean, it's not as if the Lord hasn't been kind and fellowship hasn't been restored. But that was a short-lived spring because I was not careful. It's not that it can't be restored. But look, repentance is not as easy as people say. Guard against the little sins. They will rob you. Guard against half measures. When the Lord seems to come and to fill things, don't become lazy and ride, you know, like on the escalator. Samuel Rutherford, one more time. Rutherford said this, When the heavenly gales blow, when the spring breezes blow, put out every inch of the sail. Catch it all. When you are in one of those seasons of the Christian life where it's like everything is very beneficial to you, do not become lazy and pull in sail. Throw it all out. Make room. Say to your friends, look, I'd love to hang out this weekend, but I've got some other things I want to do. Spend extraordinary time. Seek the Lord in finding times, one Puritan author said. There are times where the king seems to be passing by. Like the blind man, cry out, Son of David, have mercy on me. And do not shut up, no matter who tells you to shut up. Put out all the sail. Catch it all. Be on guard against half measures. Let me give one last story and we'll be done. Robert Murray McShane, my second all-time favorite guy. I couldn't get her to let McShane be a name, all right? So we didn't have any more kids. I'm going to try, but maybe we'll adopt somebody and call him McShane. We actually have a little Ethiopian boy in our church named McShane. I don't know what we're going to say later, but no. How'd he get McShane? Robert Murray McShane, the young pastor that was renowned in the 19th century for being one of the godliest men. You can buy his memoirs. They're very stirring. Leader of a great revival. McShane, after he died like age 29, 30. When he died and his friend put out the memoirs of his journals and things and sermons, he was wonderfully popular. There was an Englishman who went to a bookstore, and a Christian guy. He went to the Christian bookshop to get a copy of the memoirs. And there was a Scottish guy there. Now, this is right after the death, all right? And he hears the guy talking, and he's Scottish. So he says, oh, you're from Scotland. Well, like all good people, he says, so did you know McShane, you know? Like, oh, you're from America. Oh, do you know so-and-so? All right, so he said, actually, I did. He was a close friend of Robert Murray McShane, a college friend and a pastor. And he said, what do you think was the secret of his holiness? Now, if you read the memoirs, you find all these letters written at his death where everybody tells you what they think the secret of his holiness was. But this man said this. The Englishman said, what do you think it was? Oh, wait, I'll tell you. It was his carefulness, wasn't it? And his friend stopped and said, you know, I think you're right. He was careful when we were careless. Now, when they looked at McShane, his friends also wrote this. Grace comes natural to McShane. In other words, holiness is easy for him. That is a lie. It wasn't. Read his own journals. You can see it wasn't. What the difference was carefulness. We are passionate people. Are we careful? Listen to the last verse of John Newton's hymn. Dear Lord, if indeed I am thine, if thou art my son and my song, then why do I languish and pine? And why are my winters so long? Drive these dark clouds from the sky, thy soul-cheering presence restore, or take me to thee on high, where winter and clouds are no more. Can you plead with the Lord like that for yourself? Can you plead like that for this church, for American Christianity? If we're yours, why the long winters? God, return. Let's pray.